From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Coastal communities on barrier islands will not exist as they are in 30 to 150 years from now. That's according to my guest today, Dylan McNamara, associate professor and chair of the Department of Physics and Physical Oceanography at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. A four-year grant from the National Science Foundation of $1.5 million is facilitating the work of McNamara, geologists, political scientists, and others as they study how these communities will make the transition and what they can do to help. He joins me now. Dylan McNamara, welcome to Coastline.
Hi, Rachel. Thanks for having me.
And today's conversation, as a note, is pre-recorded. So paint this picture for us. What does it mean when you say that barrier islands will become uninhabitable? What about them becomes uninhabitable?
Right. Probably the most simple way to say it is that with sea level rise at the rates that it's currently going and some of the rates that we perceive to be the case in the future, the water level will be so high that it's unrealistic to imagine those communities will exist the way that they do now. Beaches won't be there. The infrastructure, the plumbing, water from the ground will be so high that it's just there will be water in the streets and so on and so forth. So, you know, this idea that you have a place at the beach where you can go and put your towel down, that won't be the case anymore. The infrastructure will kind of be failing. So it's that sense in which we mean it's not inhabitable.
And I understand that everybody wants to pin you down yeah. on a timeline particularly. But when we look at a window of 30 to 150 years, mm-hmm. that sounds like a pretty big target.
Yeah. It does, but I hope that folks appreciate that we even know that much. You know, Earth is a very complicated system. The economic markets are very complicated systems. So the idea that we can even pin it to that and that we have some foreshadowing, we know this is coming, is a wonderful thing that science has done for us. The difficulty in pinning it down explicitly is, you know, there's a whole range of scenarios with regard to how fast sea level will rise, and there's quite a bit of variation spatially in terms of how fast it rises. So some towns have faster rising sea level than other towns. And then on top of that, you know, the economic markets are adjusting differently in different places. Different places have different policies. And then you throw on top of that the potential for large storms, you know, a Sandy-type storm, say it hits one community twice in 3 or 4 years, 40 years from now, when they're already dealing with problems with sea level, that could be a scenario in which that's the tipping point for them and they're no longer there, or at least the future for them is quite different than the past has looked. So it is hard to pin down, but the bottom line is it's coming. I mean, these barrier islands are meant to move around. They're meant to kind of maintain their elevation as sea level rises, and most of the ones that are inhabited are not allowed to do that. So barring some insanely radical technological breakthrough, I can't see how those communities will exist in the way that they exist right now. So, that's our interest, is just the fact that we know that now. What kinds of steps can we take to deal with that future?
What are some of the factors that will affect, say, barrier islands along the North Carolina coast?
And by factors, you mean?
Well, things that would make sea level rise impact us more or less than, say, other coastal communities.
Yeah, so it's fairly complicated. It's not exactly my expertise, but it has to do with things like the variations in the Gulf Stream. You know, as the Gulf Stream changes its velocity and changes its spatial positioning, it kind of changes how much water is piled up at the coast in different places. And so for us in North Carolina, that's one of probably the primary driving factors. You know, there are slightly different rates of subsidence, too. You know, the ground is lowering at different rates in different places. But again, that's not totally in my realm of expertise. But those are the kind of things that spatially vary over the state of North Carolina that change the rates of sea level rise.
And of course, for years now, decades now, coastal communities in North Carolina have worked with coastal engineers mm-hmm. to figure out ways of mitigating mm-hmm. some of the issues that happen, like storms
right.
that erode a coastline much more quickly than normal erosion. Are you saying that eventually some of these engineering strategies won't work?
I wouldn't frame it like that as much as I would say that those strategies are sort of short-term solutions, and this issue that I was previously describing is a long-term problem. And, you know, those short-term strategies solve a few short timescale problems. You know, they do provide a boost to the economy. If beach nourishment was not happening in Wrightsville Beach, it'd be a very different place. There's no question about that. But, you know, importantly, one of the things that we're saying is that, number one, it's important to recognize that that is a short-term strategy. Things like beach nourishment, building up the dunes, that's not addressing sea level rise. You know, the fact that sea level might be 6 feet higher in 100 years, nourishment's not going to play a role in helping the road in Wrightsville Beach adjust to that. So that's one thing that's important. The second thing would be we're trying to shed some light on the idea that those policies in some cases can have perverse effects when it comes to dealing with a long-term strategy. So they're what we refer to as feedbacks. You know, you do a beach nourishment, property value gets higher, it sort of justifies the next beach nourishment, and it sort of creates this, to use a more of a physics-y term, inertia in the system. And it's very hard then to unwind that system from taking only that strategy and to get the system to pay attention to long-term problems that have nothing to do with that.
Is this the tension between preserving high-value properties at the beachfront versus encouraging communities to possibly retreat or
right.
relocate?
So the big R word, retreat, yeah. It is that exactly. You know, I think
you've put so much money into nourishing this beach.
And you know, the future justification for that nourishment is based on what the property value currently is. And so, you know, that justifies future nourishment, but which in some ways kind of puts the blinders on to the issues that are looming off in the horizon. So, and you know, I want to say up front, we're not at all advocating don't do beach nourishment, you know, don't do this, don't do that. We're just kind of trying to shed light on some of the dynamics that are at play in this system. And the important thing with beach nourishment is, okay, do the beach nourishment or you know, make whatever decisions you need to make, but understand that you build in feedbacks into the system and understand that there are these long-term issues that you should start paying attention to. So a lot of the policy discussions that occur in coastal communities kind of ignore this long-term issue for reasons that you might imagine, right? I mean, politics doesn't operate on 30 to 100-year timescales. So it's very difficult to get people to start to shine a light on those issues, but that's part of what we're trying to do is not just shine a light on those issues, but understand the dynamics of how these transitions are going to play out.
Now, we've heard before when we talk about sea level rise and the rate of sea level rise that it's actually accelerating or sea level rise is higher than originally projected. Is that true? Where are we now with it?
Yeah, I don't want to say a lot because it's not totally in my wheelhouse, and it's such a hot topic. But yeah, you're right about that. It is the projections that we had made, say, 20 years ago. You know, we would put these envelopes on those sea level rise curves, and we consistently keep heading at the top of the envelope. It seems to be rising even faster, you know, than we kind of thought that it would on average.
So we were conservative 20 years ago in those projections.
I think we were conservative. And my sort of pseudo-scientific opinion is that we're still a little bit conservative. You know, every time scientists go to these high-latitude regions and take a look at the dynamics that are playing out, it continues to look worse and worse for sea level.
You've said that beach renourishment in some cases does mitigate minor storm events and does make financial sense mm-hmm. in the shorter term, but major storm events can actually find an island more vulnerable after renourishment?
Yeah.
Explain that dynamic.
Probably the simplest way to say it, so this is some previous work that I had done that showed that a barrier island in its natural setting, you know, when storms of all sizes hit that barrier island, one of its response mechanisms is to have sediment land on top of the barrier island or even land behind the barrier island. And so these barrier islands for centuries and longer have been migrating up the continental shelf as sea level has risen through that process, almost like a tank wheel sort of rolling up the continental shelf. when you hold it in place and you make it so that that overwash doesn't occur for small and medium-sized storms, the biggest storms overwhelm everything. But the small and medium-sized ones, when you filter that out of the process, then the barrier island just sits there. It just sits there, and sea level rises, and it doesn't get to adjust in any shape or form. And then when the large storm comes, and you potentially would have had all these other small and medium-sized storms in the natural case to help fortify it, they haven't happened because you filtered them out. So when the big one comes, you're lower relative to sea level than you otherwise would be, and so the damage is even worse than it otherwise would be, in addition to the host of economic reasons that the damage is really, really bad. It's just the vulnerability increases. So by filtering the small and medium events, you make yourself more susceptible to the really large ones.
Now, is that something that barrier islands, and I'm thinking of Bald Head Island, for instance, because mm-hmm. that's an island that I guess was really settled in the 1970s, 1980s, mm-hmm. and they've struggled for years and worked with a coastal engineer mm-hmm. on how to mitigate some of these impacts. Mm-hmm. Is that something that is widely understood, and is that something that a community like Bald Head Island, and I'm using that as an example, might take into consideration?
Whether it's explicitly understood is not entirely clear, but I think that it has a lot to do with the fact that, you know, I think in some ways the market understands it because that filtering serves a purpose. There's a lot of money made in that filtering process. I'll just say that, I guess.
And there's still a lot to unpack here. You're listening to Coastline. We're exploring how sea level rise and the changing coastline will impact barrier islands and other types of coastal communities. We have UNCW's Professor Dylan McNamara with us today. When we come back from this break, we'll explore how scientists and economists figure out whether beach renourishment actually pays off. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Dylan McNamara is an associate professor and is the chair of UNCW's Department of Physics and Physical Oceanography. He won a $1.5 million grant from the National Science Foundation in 2017 to explore with researchers from six other universities how coastal processes and economic decisions about land use and coastal engineering interact to determine the nature and timing of adaptation to climate risk. Today's conversation is pre-recorded. Just before we went to break, I'm going to try to pin you down one more time, Dylan McNamara, on a question that I'm sure a lot of people are wondering about, and you've shared with me that you get this very kind of phone call in your office, mm-hmm. whether or not to buy in a particular coastal community. So how do you unpack the answer to that? What are some of the factors that would go into a good answer?
So, number one, I having grown up at the coastline like you and I were talking about before, I appreciate that, someone's personal affinity for the coastline. That's and for me at least, supersedes economic calculations and other things. And, you know, I'd live in a tent on the beach till the very end if it was up to me. That kind of stuff aside, the important thing I would want to convey to people who ask me questions like that is, the costs of living there are unequivocally going to go up. There's a lot of subsidies that are given to coastal communities, subsidies for beach nourishment, subsidies for flood insurances. And I think that the pressure to get those subsidies out of the system is just increasing as time is going on. And it's only a matter of time before those disappear. So even the moment those disappear, all of a sudden, if coastal communities were forced to pay the risk that they actually face, it would be quite a bit more expensive than their national flood insurance program insurance that they have to pay. So I would tell the person that expect the cost to go up, number one. Number two, there's just such a host of, depending on where they live, there's a host of environmental and physical sort of geophysical problems that are just increasing as time's going on. Things like sunny day flooding in the streets. There's places like Norfolk, Virginia or South Florida where that's something that people are facing now on certainly at least monthly basis. That even happens here in downtown Wilmington. Over the next 30 years, that'll be happening on almost a weekly basis in some locations. So I would tell them, depending on where they live, they might be dealing with things like that. I'd also tell them that, to the best of our knowledge, scientifically, saying what storms are going to do in the future is very, very difficult, but it seems to be that the literature is coalescing on the idea that storms are moving slower. They intensify very rapidly. And we have personal experience with that here, the slow moving part. When Florence came and effectively did a slow jog out of here.
Which was last September.
Right. That type of situation, I think, is something that's going to be happening more and more in the future. We saw it with Harvey as well. So I would tell that person, and it's kind of a long-winded answer, but I'd tell that person to be prepared for those things as well. But if they wrap all of that information in and they still think that they like the coast and they, I would tell them probably your property value is not going to be as high 30 years from now as it is today, given all those factors. But if for them that's fine, then that's fine.
So as part of your National Science Foundation grant-funded project, you're hoping to investigate the way that public policies, including government-managed insurance, like the National Flood Insurance Program, will impact some of these economic decisions, I guess, both personal and at the governmental level.
Right.
A little more than a year ago, the National Flood Insurance Program was on the verge of losing funding, and we reported on this, noting that the program is debt-ridden after a series of major storms going all the way back as Hurricane Katrina in 2005. Some people argue privatizing flood insurance is the way to go. Others suggest it's more important to accurately assess the flood risk, and we're not really doing a good job of that. As it stands now, what do you think needs to eventually happen with that program?
Yeah, so that is a really good question, and that's exactly the kind of question that I wouldn't answer specifically. I wouldn't say what they should do, but I can tell folks what are some of the dynamics at play. Subsidies like that, they sort of prop a market up in such a way that people are – when people are not given the market tools to evaluate the risk that they're actually facing, it creates a market that is not as adaptable as the risk potentially starts to increase. That's what I would say. And that's something that's really, really important. I think one of the things that would come out of the work that we're doing now and going to do is that, it's important to have the market reflect the true information, to give people all of the information possible so that when they're making decisions about buying coastal properties, that they're doing so as informed as they could be.
And right now, you're saying, as of early 2019, most of these properties are subsidized.
The National Flood Insurance Program, yeah, that's a pretty large subsidy. And then, like in Wrightsville Beach and many places that do beach nourishment, there's a significant amount of subsidy for that as well. And, we had a publication a few years ago that pointed out that subsidy, having been in the system for a significant period of time, now coastal properties, the actual value of that property, a piece of it comes from the subsidy. So it's a tricky business. If the subsidy were to all of a sudden go away, the intrinsic value of the property would go down. The fundamental value would go down instantaneously, but when the market realized that, it would take some time. But the bottom line is, because when you look at a home and you have some expectation about the beach that's in front of it being there for the next 30 years when you're going to buy the house, that expectation is potentially built on the subsidy. So the value that you're seeing in it is reflecting that subsidy. So if the subsidy goes away, the value changes. And it's actually surprising in some cases how much that subsidy comprises the value of the home. It can be 25, 30, 40% in some cases in locations where you have significant amounts of erosion and a lot of beach nourishment that has to go on.
You're listening to Coastline. Professor Dylan McNamara of UNCW's Department of Physics and Physical Oceanography is with us today. He's exploring, along with researchers from six other universities, how coastal communities might adapt to the effects from climate change. The project is funded by a $1.5 million grant from the National Science Foundation, and today's conversation is pre-recorded. So, as part of this project, you're looking specifically at two coastal communities right now, Nags Head, North Carolina, and Ocean City, Maryland. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And looking specifically in let me explain what that means. So the work that we're doing is generally applicable to barrier island communities up and down the East Coast and the Gulf Coast. So we're hoping to have policy implications that apply very broadly. Now, in the case of Ocean City and Nags Head, we're making a specific point to reach out to those town managers and those city council members and go and talk to them and find out the kinds of issues that they're facing so that we can make sure that the science and the economics that we're doing kind of accurately reflects both the issues that they're facing and the sort of decision frameworks that they use to decide what to do. So those two communities we're going to be doing some sort of outreach effectively to get some information from.
And right now, before this project is over and before they perhaps adopt different policies that have a longer term vision, mm-hmm. what are some of the mitigation efforts that they're paying for right now?
How do you mean? Say that again.
Like, are they paying for beach nourishment? And are there structures? Yes.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Terminal groins? Or?
Yep. Both places have beach nourishment. Ocean City has a longish history of beach nourishment since the late 80s. And Nags Head has more recently gotten involved in beach nourishment. They both have dune maintenance programs. Ocean City's case, they also have a jetty at the south end of Ocean City that interrupts a longshore sediment flow. And Nags Head, you know, also has increasing issues with standing water. And there's places in the streets after heavy-duty rains that the water doesn't really go away as quickly as it used to. So they're facing some issues with that. Yeah.
And what are some of the policies, if you didn't have to engage consensus, you know, get some kind of public consensus mm-hmm. on this. I mean, certainly the political angle on this is fraught. Mm-hmm. And that's, I imagine, what you're getting when you talk to town council members and municipal leaders.
Yeah, yeah. It's fraught, absolutely. And, you know, the timescale of politics is, like I said earlier, quite different than the timescales we're talking about. You know, my view, you know, my background's in physics and oceanography, so I try to view the system fairly generally. And I kind of, when I look at it, I can see, opportunities for policy to influence the future pathway of the system. And for example, when you have a system that's kind of sitting in its happy state, we'll call it, and then something happens to it and it gets yanked very far from its happy state, and then it migrates back to its happy state. You can either, when it gets knocked away from its happy state, there can be dynamics in the system or sort of rules in the system that get it back to its happy state as quickly as possible. But also it's true that if that happy state is constantly getting knocked away and you get knocked away, maybe there should be some rules that get you to a new, even happier state. And in the case of coastal communities, to take that metaphor and make it a little more explicit, you know, in coastal communities, after large storms, there's a significant amount of language and sort of psychology associated with, we'll be back. We'll put it right back like it was. We're not afraid. We're strong. And indeed, these coastal communities are strong. But those moments when they get shaken by a large storm event, those are moments that are particularly useful for putting the system somewhere else that could be even better. So to bring that all the way home, you know, if there are policies where you are paying insurances and potentially the insurances didn't just allow you to rebuild back exactly the way that it was before, but maybe the policy was such that you pay into it so that when that day comes, it's a little easier for you to transition out of there. So things like that, I think, would be policy prescriptions that could be useful. And, you know, and I just want to say again that when we try to investigate those things, we're not We're not doing it in a qualitative sense. We're putting mathematics behind it. We're trying to inform the mathematical hypotheses that we put into these representations as rigorously as we possibly can. We're trying to find out what people actually think. We know about how the system works from a physics standpoint, and we're putting all those pieces in a really rigorous way so we can kind of quantitatively analyze a policy prescription like I just described. We're not just picking it out of thin air. We're thinking, okay, you know, put the math into that and then see how the system plays if you rise sea level this much and, you know, if you have this much subsidy and so on and so forth.
In one of your studies, Beach Nourishment as a Dynamic Capital Accumulation Problem, mm-hmm. you write, nourishment sand that can be recovered through dredging may eventually become scarce. Mm-hmm. And one would expect variable cost to increase, which is logical,
yeah.
easy to follow.
Yeah.
If communities respond by nourishing more often, this effect could feed back on itself and further accelerate nourishment. Beaches then become increasingly artificial, and the ecological costs of nourishment grow substantially. And you also say in the current policy regime, environmental impacts of nourishment are cataloged, but they're not counted mm-hmm. as costs to mm-hmm. weigh against nourishment benefits. What are the environmental costs of nourishment?
I think in those cases, you know, it sort of varies from place to place. And that's not exactly, I'm not super knowledgeable about that, but it has to do with, you know, sea turtle issues and those kinds of things in North Carolina, for example. That's a really prominent interaction between ecology and the sort of geophysical setting.
Right. There are rules now around when people can renourish
right.
because of issues like that.
Exactly. And then, you know, more broadly, that work is pointing to, you know, there's some beach nourishment is a fairly myopic, both in space and time, a myopic process. And by that, I mean communities are thinking only about the impact on their community. So in space, they're not thinking about the town up and down necessarily. And it's myopic in time because it's like, okay, we'll do this for the next 3 years and then we'll deal with the situation down the road. We, importantly in that paper, we're pointing out that it's critical to look on a sort of larger space and time scale, even when you're thinking about nourishment, because the impacts of when you do a nourishment aren't just to your neighbor beaches. In some cases, in some settings, it can be very, very far away, the impacts that has. And if you just rush to kind of the sands out there, I'm going to go grab it before the next town grabs it, and people get involved in games like that, you can blast through sediment pretty quickly, and then, you know, you start to create this scenario where the towns that can afford to go get it, they're the ones who get preferential access to it. It starts getting more expensive. It means only the towns that can afford to go get it, and then the towns that maybe can't afford to go get it, they start getting left out in the cold, and that can create a pretty significant problem.
Well, how does the sand become scarce? Help me understand this. It sounds like matter is disappearing. If sand is falling off the beach through mm-hmm. erosion mm-hmm. processes,
yeah.
then aren't you just going back when you're dredging to renourish, scooping up the same sand that fell off the beach?
Right.
Where does it go?
It's a great question. I'm glad you asked it because it's sort of a common misconception that even I had, for a long period of time, is that you just think when you go out in the ocean, it's just sand everywhere, sand, sand, sand. But that sand that's on the beach is a very nice and unique kind of sand. The grain size is very specific. And it's not everywhere out there in the ocean. You can't just go out there and dig up a hole somewhere in the ocean and find the sand that's the same sized grain sand as we have on the beach. In fact, there's quite a bit less out there than you'd think. And when it gets eroded off the beach, it gets kind of distributed out there with a bunch of muds and other things. And you can't pump up all the mud and throw that on the beach. That would not be good. It would wash away immediately. So finding areas offshore that have the kind of sand that is the useful sand for us to put on the beach, it's not an infinite reservoir out there at all, by any means. From location to location, you know, how much is out there varies. And some states, I think, have been better at kind of mapping where those borrow areas exist compared to other states. There are cases like, for example, in South Florida, where it gets deep relatively quickly offshore, that they're kind of running out of that nourished sand already. And so there's discussions going on about, manufacturing sand in a laboratory so that they can put it on the beach because it's such a critical part of, you know, like South Miami and those places. But to answer your question, it's not just an infinite reservoir of sand out there. There's only so much.
You also published a paper that looked at how hurricanes affected wave activity on the East Coast, how storms are affecting waves. Is that, and you're furrowing your brow as if you're not sure what I'm referring to.
Which title? Which was the...
I don't have the title in front of
my
me.
My publication list is so long, I just forgot.
But what factor do big storms play in the progression of this whole discussion?
Great question. That one's a tough one to answer, the way that storms... how they're going to play out in the future. And I importantly, I think as we're kind of building up the work that we're doing right now on this National Science Foundation grant, we kind of think of the two in some ways as being different. They're interacting with each other. In other words, if sea level's a lot higher, a certain size storm will seem a lot worse when sea level's higher. Sure, that's pretty obvious. But sea level is like this sort of slow ticking that's happening in the background. And you don't walk out every day and say, oh, man, sea level's, 0.001 millimeters higher than it was yesterday. No one does that. And you don't even walk out and say, wow, sea level looks higher than it does. I remember when I was a kid, people don't do that either. So it's kind of this happening out there in the background where storms are very obvious. There are these giant perturbations to the system. And that's why, kind of as I was alluding to earlier, if when the storm hits, it's an opportunity to deal with the fact that the sea level rise thing is happening also. And maybe this is an opportune time for us to kind of move away from the scenario that we're currently in. So that's one thing I'd say. The other thing I guess I'd say importantly for North Carolina, and I think the paper that you were referring to, that publication, had to do with, the shape of the North Carolina coastline. It's a fairly unique shape. These capes, they almost look like giant sort of scalloped shapes. I have a colleague who's done some fantastic work kind of explaining where those shapes come from. And in that paper and some follow-up papers, what we've done is to show how if the wave climate changes, not so much the storms, but the overall, averaged over a year wave climate, are you getting more waves from the north or more waves from the south, those kinds of questions, as that changes around, how that might alter the shape of the North Carolina coastline.
You're listening to Coastline. Professor Dylan McNamara of UNCW's Physics and Physical Oceanography Department is with us today. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to learn about strategies for making coastal communities more resilient. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Today, it's an exploration of the changes coming to coastal communities and how they might adapt and become more resilient as risks from climate change, such as sea level rise, impact them. Dylan McNamara is an associate professor and chair of the Department of Physics and Physical Oceanography at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. In 2017, he won a grant from the National Science Foundation of $1.5 million to spearhead a project with researchers from six other universities that examines the adaptation process. This conversation is pre-recorded. Dylan McNamara, just to be clear, we're talking about sea level rise as something that is happening. There's no debate on that. What about storms and the intensity of storms? Are they becoming more intense as a result of climate change?
Yeah, so that is a really hot topic. And there's a lot of active research going on to try to answer that question, and it's a very difficult question to answer, and I don't think yet that we have a definitive answer. And one of the things I think that's important for all listeners out there, whether or not that's happening, whether or not storms are getting more intense or aren't, doesn't mean that climate change is or is not happening. Climate change is happening. Storms are going to do what they're going to do. Climate change is happening. The Earth's getting warmer. That is absolutely unquestioned.
So why is that something that's hard to establish
scientifically? It's difficult because, number one, from a data perspective, we don't have a lot of data. There's not a ton of storms that have happened over the last 100 years. If we were going to ask a question about, okay, what's going to happen with Category 5s in Wrightsville Beach? Well, how many Category 5s have ever hit Wrightsville Beach? So it's to say something statistically accurate, you need that system to play out for decades. At least a decade or more to say, okay, now that the Earth is getting warmer, this is the impact that we have on storms. But even with that data issue, you know, some very, very good scientists are doing some important work using computer models to explore, okay, you warm up the Earth, now let's run all the storms and all the stuff that typically happens and just try to get a sense for if these models are suggesting there's going to be more. And I think that, like I alluded to earlier, one of the things that's coming out really recently is this idea that they're going to slow down. The driving current, one of the things that happens when the Earth warms is the poles warm faster than the equator. So overall, in some ways, when you have that thermal gradient is not quite as significant, the steering currents overall just aren't as significant. So storms just aren't kind of moving around as fast as they otherwise would. So I think they think that. They think that their intensification period is they can intensify very rapidly in some cases, and we've seen that recently. And then the third thing is that it does seem as though they are leaning towards the idea that the really large storms will probably happen more frequently. But again, I don't think that that's a closed case. And honestly, you know, for the work that we're doing, we kind of explore all those options. You know, we say, okay, this is coastal communities, this is the economics, these are the kinds of decisions people make when they buy homes, these are the subsidies, this is the geophysical setting, this is the erosion. Let's see what happens if you put this many storms in. Okay, now let's see what happens when you put this many in. So we can kind of give a prognosis that's saying, well, wow, if the storms get really bad, it goes this way. If the storms are kind of intermediate, it goes this way.
This study that you've undertaken that's funded by the National Science Foundation asserts that changing climatic and geomorphological processes, and I'm reading from the abstract, are likely to increase risks of living at the coast in the future and to increase the value of reducing those risks through engineering. So, how can engineering reduce risks when we're talking about, for example, barrier islands becoming uninhabitable?
Yeah, so I think that, you know, one thing to point to that's a really big area where that could apply is, as we were talking about earlier, this idea of transitioning away from the coastline, there are huge environmental costs. So imagine that happened tomorrow. Imagine everyone just left, say, Atlantic City and just left it there.
Huge environmental costs?
Environmental costs, yeah. So say imagine everyone just leaves Atlantic City tomorrow. All the structure that's there, the gas stations, the hotels, has just left. It's sitting there in the water. That environmental costs with that are significant. So engineering is going to have something to say about how those environmental costs are borne and how they might be mitigated. So that would be one example, I'd say.
So this would really be, you're talking about retreat, relocation.
Yes.
You called it the R word earlier.
Right.
But this is something that coastal communities are going to have to really grapple with in a very real way, not just those who are a little more forward thinking.
Yes, I think so. I mean, I think it's probably the case that some people have already left certain areas, like, you know, after Sandy, I'm sure there's many people who left. So people have left, and there are also people that will be there to the very last moment. I mean, they will be potentially on the roof of their house with water on their downstairs floor. They haven't seen the carpet on their downstairs floor in a really long time, but they still live in the upstairs. In between, you know, there's going to be something. All the rest of the people are going to do something in between, and trying to understand what that is a really big part of the work that we're doing. And we just want to, as I was talking about environmental costs, we want to make sure that as that transition happens for the in-between folks, that the environmental costs are mitigated as much as they can be, that the sort of social costs are mitigated as much as they can be.
How do building codes need to change? I mean, I guess we're talking about two different types of communities here. There's one type of community that will just need to not be abandoned, but people will need to move out and shut it down in a responsible, planned way. Mm-hmm. Another type of community, I think, would hope to become a little more resilient and able to deal with some of these issues like sea level rise and more intense storms, if that's what's happening. Mm-hmm. So if we look at the second type that hopes to stay, first of all, are there beaches along the North Carolina coast that will be spared? Or are we talking about people eventually needing to move away from what we think of as the beaches in the state?
Yep. I think barrier islands, it's hard for me to imagine that most of the barrier islands that we have won't be uninhabitable on the kind of timescales we were talking about. There are possibilities for certain places, I think, even on those long timescales. And part of the reason I feel that way is because if you look to the past, it's not unprecedented that humans have lived at the coastline with an entirely different approach. You know, in the old days, in the Outer Banks, homes were on logs and they would just roll them around. In the wintertime, they would roll them to the back of the island because they knew that's when storms got bad. And then in the summertime, they'd roll them up. And so that idea, that sort of mentality of kind of living with the natural environment and not sort of what we refer to in a sort of science or physics-y sense as not coupling to the environment, not I'm going to push the environment and it'll push back and then I'm pushing and we're pushing back and forth. More, okay, let the environment do what it's going to do and then I'll just kind of sort of bob and weave with it. And so there's definitely the potential for communities to maybe take on some of those characteristics. I'll tell you, I, for example, work with Bald Head Island Conservancy, and we have active discussions about this all the time. You know, that community, it just doesn't have the rigid infrastructure that some of the, like in Atlantic City has, for example, the roads, there's golf carts, you know, right? And so a community like that.
And that's also an island that over the years right. has lost some of its edges.
Yes.
It's lost roads on the perimeter.
Indeed, right. And so for a place like Bald Head to begin to have discussions with someone like me about the future, it's not out of the question that they might be able to adapt in the kind of ways that they need to maintain some active community there on Bald Head Island. Yeah.
So if we look at a place like the city of Wilmington, you alluded to the fact earlier that downtown Wilmington near Water Street sees more flooding days than it has in the past. Mm-hmm. The number of days is on the increase. Mm-hmm. And that also impacts, of course, the other side of the river, where the battleship is. What does the city of Wilmington need to do from a planning point of view around that? And how far up will the flooding creep?
It's a good question. I don't know if I have a specific policy prescription for them. I think it's important to say, though, that, you know, to put some numbers on those issues, you know, the NOAA, who has a tide gauge right here, right across the river there by the battleship, that tide gauge has been in operation for a long time. They've come at that tide gauge and put some future projections for sea level rise. And even under what I refer to as fairly conservative estimates for sea level rise, on about a 40-year time scale, you're looking at water on Water Street about 70 days a year, which you know, that is a discussion. People, I'll just say this, people should be talking about that. And that's a conservative estimate. I don't know how the business community around downtown Wilmington would think, given that, you know, every week or so, there's going to be a significant amount of water on Water Street and creeping up into other areas.
Given that there's a park that will be under construction soon, right. set to open in 2020 sometime, that will have a huge amphitheater.
Right.
We'll have trails for people.
Right. I mean, it's absolutely critical. You know, we have a new coastal engineering program starting at UNCW in my department, and I was talking to the Board of Trustees earlier this week and just telling them that it's so important to think about these issues now. And this is why part of why we need to train young scientists and engineers to deal with these issues is because the economic engine of this region so heavily depends on both, obviously, the downtown area and then the coastline that we need people thinking about these long-term problems.
So we're not talking about these issues right now. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I shouldn't say that. I'm not entirely sure what people are or aren't talking about. But I know that at the beach or up and down the East Coast of the United States, the topic of transitioning away and from those areas is not something that's an active part of the political process. That is for sure.
Just last month, the Star News reported that no buildings owned by the city of Wilmington can withstand a strong Category 4 hurricane. Right. And of course, city officials are aware of that, and they're working to fix that.
Right.
But what kinds of building codes, what kind of building standards does a place like the city of Wilmington need to really be looking at?
Yeah, that's a good question. Building codes is a little bit outside my wheelhouse. I'm not entirely sure. And I, you know, as a scientist, I even feel like it's probably very difficult to say, okay, this building will withstand X winds. And then I think sometimes X minus 20 miles an hour will still do some damage to that building. So I don't have a good answer for you with respect to what should happen to building codes, but I do think that on these barrier island communities in particular, given their vulnerability with respect to sea level rise, that these discussions about the long-term future, it's critical that they begin happening.
So is part of creating more resilient communities then changing the way we talk about potential impacts from these storms? You look at Hurricane Florence, which was a surprise in a lot of ways. It didn't have the same wind speed as was originally predicted. It spent a lot of time off the coast picking up, moisture, size, pressure. How does all that work? And it seems like predicting storm surge is a relatively new idea that came online, I think, last year for the National Weather Service.
Yeah.
But what about pressure and how we look at these storms and what they might do to a coastal community?
So what I was saying earlier about storms slowing down, that's a big part of what you're referring to, or the impacts of that are what you're talking about. So when a storm slows down, it just has more chance to gain moisture. If it's over a warm ocean. So the rain that can be associated with a slow-moving storm can be really significant, and that's what we saw with Florence. And, yeah, storm surge forecasting is getting a bit more accurate indeed. But, you know, again, I'd kind of point to, you know, I guess if I was going to say anything about Florence to answer your question, I would just say be careful. You know, the coastal communities here, they didn't quite take the hit that they potentially could have. And, you know, there had just been a beach nourishment project. The beach was pretty wide. It absorbed a decent amount of the sort of wave energy that hit the coastline. And we see this in a lot of places where, you know, the beach nourishment can actually do a pretty decent job of buffering the impacts of a storm. My be careful point would be careful not to, you know, forecast or extrapolate that all the way into the future. Doesn't mean we're always going to be okay. And in fact, when the big one does come, it might be way worse than you can possibly imagine. And then furthermore, if you wrap that on top of the fact that you might be looking at water in your streets on sunny days and so on and so forth, and insurance is starting to go up and all of those types of things. To me, as a physicist, I would refer to those as signs of instability. You know, the system's kind of shaking around a little bit and starting to seem like it might be about to do something quite different.
Are there any progressive coastal communities that you can point to in the world, not even just on the U.S. East Coast, but anywhere where you say they're taking into account the factors they need to be taking into account for long-term sustainability?
I don't have good examples of massive and it might just be my ignorance, but I don't have good examples of massive, you know, sort of first world, giant, human-occupied coastal settings that are that forward-thinking. But we can just look to indigenous cultures all over the world. And they, you know, as a part of their culture, they often pass down through generations the story of how dynamic their environment is. They don't just look at the past, say, 20 years and say, this is what's been going on for 20, 30 years, and this is what's going to go on forever. So I think that, you know, you can look to communities like that and get some deep insights into how to live with this world that we're about to face of significant change happening at the coastline. We've been lucky to kind of settle the coasts, and all this population migration towards the coasts happened over a period of time of relatively really low rates of sea level rise. So it's almost like we got a window of time where we could really get there and start setting our feet in the ground and building giant condos and so on and so forth, and kind of deriving a lot of market income out of these systems. If those environments were changing really rapidly over the last 200 years, the coastline would look quite different. And so we're about to face that for the next 200 years. And I think that we have to think a little bit more long term and maybe adapt some of these indigenous values about how nature changes.
And that's this edition of Coastline. Professor Dylan McNamara, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
Coastline's producer is Rachel Keith. Production manager is Caitlin Hanrahan. Caitlin Freund is our web and social media master. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at WHQR.org. Get the podcast, find it on the HQR app, or just tune in for the rebroadcast Sunday afternoon at 3. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.